I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay, the podcast where each week we do a conversational deep dive analysis into a film. Today we are talking about Up in the Air, the 2009 film directed by Jason Reitman, screenplay by Jason Reitman and Sheldon Turner, based on the novel by Walter Kern. I am joined by the Beyond the Screenplay team, Trisha Rand.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Hello, hello.
And Alex Kayotis.
Hi.
So I'm really excited to talk about Up in the Air because I like it a lot. and it was, so before Lessons from the Screenplay was a thing, I had committed to, I'm going to read a bunch of screenplays and learn as much as I can. And as I started to read them, I was like, well, I'm going to write blog posts about each one I read, and that'll help me internalize lessons and then be able to share them with people. And basically, as I started to write the first like blog post or two, I was like, I think this could be a video essay. Strangely, one of the very first blog posts I wrote was about Up in the Air because it was one of my favorite movies. I knew the script was great. And then I, you know, was reading it for this purpose and extracting all these cool lessons. And I was like, I'm going to write a blog post about it. And so it was almost a ready to go video, but for some reason it never became a video. But I found the script for it, and tons of the things that I identify in the Up in the Air script, we went on later to make videos about. So maybe I'll like share the script to patrons because it is kind of like fun. And there's a lot of important things to learn from the screenplay, as we will talk about.
Nice.
But yeah, this movie is really, really good. I remember a hazy memory of seeing it. It came out in 2009, so it was like the year after I graduated college. And so I was back in my hometown, and I feel like I went to see a movie. And I was like, oh, wait, they still make movies like this? Like, this is a character story, and just no one dies, and it's self-contained, and it's well-designed. So it's kind of left me wondering, like, is this the last 90s movie? Like,
maybe.
I feel like it might be. And I also, it was funny watching that this time I was getting Groundhog Day vibes from it and some of the, like, you know, the design of the protagonist and his arc, and rereading the script from, you know, 5-6 years ago. I also thought that then, so I haven't gone insane, which is good. But yeah, so I love this movie. I think it's charming. It does so many plot structure things so well. The performances are great. 3 Academy Awards nominations for all 3 of the leads is pretty impressive. So I think, yeah, it's a great movie. There's a lot to be learned from it. What do you guys think of this movie? Trisha, what do you tell me about Up in the Air?
Yeah, so I saw this in the theater. You know, it came out in December, or it was like late at the end of the year, right? I think it actually came out in November, but I caught it, I think, in like maybe early December or something of that year. And I went on a date to see it. It's actually a great date movie. I don't know. I feel like because it's so rich for conversation afterward, like it's the kind of thing where you can like definitely go out for a drink afterward and like really dig into it. And like, I don't know, it's really great.
Did you sneak out after, or did you say goodbye?
Protocol is tricky. I don't know. Yeah, no, it's just, but the one thing I remember is that I like audibly gasped in the theater when the reveal happens, where she like opens the door and the kid runs up the stairs and you're like, it could be okay. And then the guy comes in and you're like, oh, it's not okay. It's really, really bad. And it, you know, it is a twist, and it's so, the movie, so I want to like want to get to it later, but the movie so consciously avoids hinting it to you at all in any way. There are no breadcrumbs. You could never know, right, that is coming. And which in some cases when twists like that happen, it feels cheap when it happens, but in this case it's so, the themes are so embedded in every part of this film that it just feels like, why didn't I see that coming? And it's like, the movie literally never hinted it to me even one time in the character or in the dialogue or anything. But it's so, that twist is so earned by the thematic work that's being done that it's just like, it's brilliant and it punches you straight in the gut, and it's unforgettable. Like, to be honest, I haven't seen this movie since I sat in that movie theater on that date in 2009, but I remembered so much of it, but especially like everything about that moment and how it's filmed and how it's approached. And
right.
Like there's, yeah, it's a, what a testament to like the structure work and everything that's been done that leads to that moment.
It's also the kind of thing that when you then rewatch the movie, you're like, oh, okay, that's why she maybe didn't answer that question, or she didn't really acknowledge, you know, it's like, it doesn't feel completely out of left field where like we wrote a character based on this one ideology and then completely changed it later. It's like, no, we embedded it in a way where it wasn't hinting at it. But at the same time, when you look back through, you're going, ah, okay. Right. Like that's why she never maybe didn't quite go there. Yeah.
There's one line I noticed this time where she says, back home, I don't get to act the way I do with you.
Mm.
Right.
And that's the only thing she says that does hint that there's a home life that is different from this.
Right.
Yeah.
But it goes by so quick and you can assume, you know, whatever.
Right. You can read that in lots of ways. And I do feel like, you know, watching it again, Vera Farmiga's performance, I think you can find moments where it's like, okay, she's wrestling with things. And now that I know what she's wrestling with, this all plugs in. But yeah, in the text, that you have very, very little, basically nothing to hold on to.
Right. But yeah, I think it's that thing where, like, I don't know, it's just, that's the hallmark of a really, really good screenplay, right? Where, like, there's a true sense of, I don't know what's going to happen next. And then when that thing arrives, it's the only thing that could possibly have happened.
Right.
But there was no way for you to anticipate it. Even a seasoned moviegoer or screenwriter like me. And at the time, of course, I was a much younger screenwriter. But even so, I was like, there's no way for me to have guessed like that was coming. So much of the way that this plays out too has that unexpected, like, okay, they're going to go to the sister's wedding. Is it going to go terribly? I actually don't know. Like, I kind of can't predict what's going to happen in any given scene. Only it all feels so right. And like it all clicks together and holds together so well. Yeah, it's really self-contained. And it's small of like in a way it's a small movie, but because it is this intimate character study, the stakes feel really big for the character. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just the character of, what's Stritzkin's character's name? Ryan. Yeah. Ryan Bingham. It's so clear, like what his problem is, the thing that he needs to learn. You understand kind of why he, you know, the weakness and the fears that he has and the defense mechanisms, like it's all so well drawn, and he's partnered with such amazing characters on all sides of him to push him along that arc, but also dramatize it and make us like really understand and question all these things. That it's a good movie, and we don't have a whole lot of them. I like this one.
A good original movie. I know it's based on a novel, but it's a good original film.
I mean, so like there's so many things to talk about. The design. So actually, one of the things, because character plot structure stuff is all really interesting, but also, as I was saying, you know, this movie feels kind of like the last 90s movie, and it was made in 2009, so obviously not 90s, but it was this kind of before era in technology, which was kind of fun to revisit, where like they don't have iMessage, they have iChat, and the new technology that Natalie Keener is bringing into this firing services is video chats.
Especially now, that was hilarious. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, you know, Ryan's making fun of her of like, oh yeah, I can set up a MySpace, but like, do you really know what stuff is? So that was just kind of like fun to revisit what technology was like not that long ago, but that it was different enough that I feel like in some ways this movie couldn't be made in the same way today. Which I think is just always fascinating to look at, like, you know, movies that need to take place in a certain time period because of the technology, where they can, you know, they have the internet, so she can Google Ryan and know certain things about him, but we don't have Facebook, we don't have smartphones, we don't have all the stuff that might have, you know, Ryan could have gone and figured out her life potentially if she had an Instagram kind of thing.
But wait, I want to hear from Brian and Alex about their first encounters with this movie, because they got really excited when you brought up that you wanted to talk about it. Like, more so than I did, because I hadn't seen it that recently, and I didn't know how much I love this movie.
Brian, Alex?
Pick one. I'll go. One whose name, shares a character.
Yeah, I mean, I remember just being really, really moved by this movie that I did not expect to be moved by. You know, I remember seeing the trailers and it looked fun. It looked like a kind of a stylish movie with actors I liked. And it looked like a good dramedy fun time. And for it to have such a gut punch and for it to kind of get existential by the end and really end on this open-ended note that just leaves you a bit unsettled. There's kind of like a peacefulness to the final shot and the ending, but there's also kind of like a sudden cutoff to it. The music and the sound just goes away. So it was a really interesting experience of going in expecting a very conventional, like 90s movie, and feeling like it was elevated in this way. And I got more bang for my buck. Like I got a more kind of, I'm going to reflect on my life experience than I expected from like the marketing and the trailers and just the overall style of the film. So it was just one of those really wonderful, pleasant surprises where you go into a movie theater expecting one thing and you get that, but then you get more and you walk out like feeling like feels and having thoughts and like you said, wanting to have conversations after the movie, Trisha. It feels so rare, I guess, because there's just this, it's like this dying breed of just simple, dramedy, I guess, character study, mid-budget movie. It's not a super indie art film. It's right. Very accessible. It's very easy to watch, but it's also got really complex characters and really good performances. It's not cheap. It's not overly simple. It's got really interesting nuance, and there's scenes where people don't even say anything and exchange a look, and it means everything. So it is like a movie that we don't get anymore. You know, we get the like A24 weirdo art film, or we get, you know, the kind of the big broadest movies. Yeah. And it does feel like this, whatever this is, we have to kind of go back in time to retrieve it. And Up in the Air is just one of the best examples of whatever this is.
It was a weird time in the movie industry too, because it was right after the writer's strike, the financial crash. Yeah, it was just, you know, I think when we were doing our like favorite movies of the aughts episode, all of our movies tended to be concentrated in, or like the bulk of them from all four of us were concentrated in the first half of the aughts, because the second half of the aughts, especially like 08, 09, 2010, were like, what was happening? It was just a really uncertain and inconsistent sort of time in the movie business where they didn't have their feet under them at all and they didn't know what they were going to make. And I think that's part of the like charm of this movie, is that it does, like you say, it feels like a 90s movie in its construction, and I agree. But obviously the world that it captures is so unique to the exact moment that it came out.
Yeah.
I think it was on a recent episode, Michael, you were talking about like every movie should be a period piece, and this movie really is in that sense.
Yeah. Well, and to the point of, which I didn't know the first time I watched it, but you know, the interviews with all these people that have lost their jobs are real interviews with people that really lost their jobs. And that was a thing that I believe was added kind of later as they were editing, and they kind of realized, oh, we should like see these people. If we're kind of talking about this thing, let's make it really about
them.
And
it was so raw in that moment.
I mean, we're hiring these people to be in our movie. Therefore, we get to pay them to be in the movie. Yep. So it was kind of a nice like circular thing there. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's great. Yeah. Well, Brian, what do you,
You know, talking about our top tens of the aughts, this was, we just did Punch Drunk Love, and that and this were both like, oof, like right in the 12, you know, kind of thing. And both of them, rewatching them lately, I'm just like, man, maybe I have to rethink if they were, you know? So it's a good month for movies from the mid aughts that were almost in my top 10 that are kind of unconventional rom-coms about a guy obsessed with frequent flyer miles. So that's
our theme.
Specific Letterboxd list.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, no, as you were saying, like I love, you know, I love movies that are both entertaining and have something to say, right? And you kind of get, as you were saying, Alex, sometimes you get one or the other. You get like, oh, I'm like, we're like stewing in this theme, but everything's weird and off-putting and whatever. Or it's just like, this is a safe movie where there's like a pasted on theme that is basically meaningless, you know? And Jason Reitman is good at these movies where it's like, this theme is very strong and it's sort of in your face in a way that is unabashed. Like, you literally have the character in the first 10 minutes being like, this is my philosophy on life. I am talking to you about it. But then you do the thing, you do the movie thing, right? You face him with all the opposing philosophies, or in the case of Vera Farmiga, the what is the 100% of this philosophy, right? You know, and how does that look? And so, yeah, Thank You for Smoking, Young Adult. I haven't seen some of his more recent ones, but like, he is good at doing this kind of thing that feels like it's the right balance, where it's like, if you just want to go watch kind of an entertaining movie, you do kind of get that. Like, if you want to turn your brain off, you can choose to watch this movie that way. But also, if you want to go in and have a movie kind of really make you think about your own life choices, like, you can read it that way too. And, you know, that's why I love Fight Club, right? Like, few movies are good at doing both, that kind of let you decide how seriously you want to engage with it, or if you just want to watch something that's kind of a piece of entertainment. Yeah, so lots to talk about. I you know, also early Anna Kendrick, who is the microest of micros, and I just knew I loved her right away. And it's weird because the other early movie that we know her from was directed by Jason Reitman's British twin brother, Edgar Wright, Scott Pilgrim. Right. Mm-hmm. So we were seeing the early stages of her career, those of us who aren't big Twilight fans, at least, who, you know, she was new to us.
Yeah, I feel like this was the movie that like launched 1,000 crushes on Anna Kendrick, in my mind anyway.
Similar to Groundhog Day, what you were pointing out, Michael, it does remind me of that, and that for a very specific reason, which is this has the beautiful like chicken and egg premise protagonist match, where like you have a protagonist who has like a very specific life philosophy, as you're pointing out, of like, what's in your backpack? You can't be tied down. Motion is living. And then you take that and you marry it to the premise. And like, I don't know which came first, right? Because like, it's based on a novel. And, you know, I know that Walter Kearns, when he was writing the novel, was like, knew a lot of people who were like, you know, traveled, you know, 350 days a year kind of thing. So I don't really know. But like, if you look at the premise and then you ask yourself, who is the central person that like would live this way? And what would his life philosophy have to be? And what would it mean for that character? What would then that flaw be that's like embedded in the philosophy, right? So if you take the premise of like, okay, here's a guy who literally travels and fires people for a living. Who would that guy be? What must his problem be? Let's dig into that. Or you could start it over. What if this was your life philosophy? What kind of job would you have? And then logically follow that extension out. Mm-hmm. I don't know which place you start in this case, but either place gets you to this incredibly literalization of like a life philosophy. Mm-hmm. The movie's called Up in the Air. It's like, we get it. It's this is what you would do if this is what you truly believed about whatever. But, and as you're pointing out, you know, as you pointed out, Michael, it seems like almost too on the nose in a lot of ways, but they sell it to us so effectively that it, instead of feeling like we're being hit in the face with it, it feels like we're being invited into it. And it's so perfectly married to everything that comes after, or like that the premise naturally gives rise to this story about this particular person, because those two things, it's not just like, what if this guy did this thing? Like, that's like the dartboard way of constructing a premise and a character arc. And this is not that way. This is all of a piece.
Yeah. And then you juxtapose that against the sort of victims of his job, you know, who exactly. you're opening up with.
Yep.
And I mean, that's why I love the real interviews, because that makes it just feel so much more visceral and so much more real. You know, it's not just who would this guy be, but it's like it immediately communicates to the audience, like, this is somebody who's comfortable with doing something to other people that we probably wouldn't be comfortable with, or the average person wouldn't be comfortable with, because that's how removed he is from sort of empathy and emotion and et cetera. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It makes me realize that, you know, on the noseness feels bad, I think, when it is that kind of like pasted on top, like you said, Brian, we see sometimes like cookie cutter movies where it's like, yeah, this, you know, now this scene needs to happen. Now it's the midpoint. So I guess something's got to change. And here's the crisis. Oh, but it's easily resolved. And here's the theme, everybody. And when we feel those things aren't naturally coming out of the story, that's mm-hmm. when it feels like on the nose in a bad way. This movie is so good because even though everything's so clear and so strong, it's all integrated. You know, like every character is here to serve that theme, to serve like the main character's journey. And so it doesn't feel bad on the nose. So I think it's a good example of like clarity and almost being like forceful with your theme doesn't have to show up in a bad way if every element in your movie is like integrated and serving that single theme. And this movie, yeah, it does feel like every choice, every turning point is exactly right and natural, and not just, oh, we're on page, you know, 70, so now this happens.
Yeah
I feel like, and I think Trisha, you must have said that this at some point, but yeah, I think it's much better to have a really obvious theme than no detectable theme right. whatsoever. And yes. I think that yeah, I think there might be a kind of thing where, you know, I think as movie watchers, sometimes when we know something is wrong, we feel something is wrong, we go for the obvious thing. I think we talked recently in an episode where, Brian, I think you mentioned like actors get blamed for bad dialogue mm-hmm. all the time.
Right.
Because
Godfather
the audience...
3.
Yes. Right. Yes. Thank you. Yeah, because the audience feels like something isn't working. What am I looking at? I'm looking at this person. That person is bad at whatever they're doing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can't fault anyone for, you know, not understanding the inner workings of how a movie is made. But I do feel like some of these things were like a fear of being too on the nose with what my movie is about might come from this kind of like, you know, bad experiences with movies where it feels like it's on the nose and hitting you over the head in a bad way that are actually just like other problems. But I think it's a good thing if you can walk into a room where someone is watching a movie and be like, what's that movie about? And the audience can be like, it's about this guy and he like fires people, but really he needs to learn to like live and love it. Like, it's good if the audience knows what your movie is about. So don't be afraid of that.
Right. I would love to do an experiment where like you get Meryl Streep and Daniel Day-Lewis to act out a scene, but like everything is sort of a little off, like the dialogue is off and you have that thing that like people shot on their phones and you can hear the room tone from each time it cuts, like the room tone changes, right? And like the lighting is bad. And I would genuinely love to like hand that to a stranger who's never heard of these actors and be like, do you think these actors are good? Right.
Right.
You know, because it's like you don't realize the things that your brain is doing, like the things that don't add up in your brain. You don't realize what's happening a lot of the time. So you just sort of, like you said, blame what's in front of you. Anyway, we're talking about Up in the Air, but that's something I want to do.
Now I want to see like a really serious, like David Fincher directed. Yeah, Daniel Day-Lewis, Meryl Streep version of The Room. Like,
yeah, right.
Take the script, make the hell out of it.
Yeah.
Like,
but don't change
Where
a word.
Would that be? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That'd be interesting.
You just add subtext. Oh. Hi, Mark.
Well, I mean, all of this just reminds me so much that, you know, all of this work has been done on the page, but then is supported by the filmmaking. So I was reading the screenplay for Up in the Air today. And it's a hell of a read. I strongly recommend it. It's very accessible online. Just go and get your hands on it. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
But what it talks about, that like early sequence where Ryan is packing his suitcase, it talks about like, this is a ballet worthy of Tchaikovsky. Mm-hmm. Like, this is this is beautiful. The rhythm and the precision with which he like puts his shoes in and like the coat slides off the hanger, the hand clicks the light switch without looking. Like the script is not saying like, here's a medium shot of a hand hitting a light switch. It's describing the like sort of thematic feeling of who Ryan is. And then, you know, Jason Reitman, who obviously wrote probably, I'm sure, all of those lines that I'm describing about in the screenplay, he is then translating that when he puts his director hat on and is like, okay, we're going to do this series of cuts or whatever. But again, it starts with like the character work that's on the page, and then it's supported by the filmmaking. And so, you know, Alex, I think, called this movie stylish a few minutes ago. And yeah, this movie is stylish as hell, but it needs to be stylish because it has to sell us Ryan's lifestyle, right? Yeah. In order to get us into like Ryan's mind and make us think that Ryan is cool, we need to see how people react to him, how like effortlessly things come to him. Like he talks about like, you hate these things about traveling. I love these things about traveling. And it's because they're easy for him, right? The way he navigates the world. And that's how the character is conveyed on the page. And then the filmmaking, also the editing, the shot selection, like, and yeah, the performances too, all support that. So.
Well, and it's showing that he's good at what he does. And that's, as we've talked about many times, a classic thing that gets us into a protagonist where
expertise,
which is, you know, a tall mountain to climb in some ways, because, you know, Ryan is someone that goes around and fires people, but he's good at his job. He's good at flying. But he also, when he fires people, he has this like empathy to it. Like he does have this, sure, he's doing a, you know, despicable ish thing if you want to look at it that way, but he approaches it with care and wants to do it really well and like understands the vulnerable place that other people is in. He's not callous with it, which would just make him totally a bad guy.
Right.
Yeah.
Reminds me, we talked about in our Godfather episode, you know, if your protagonists are criminals, make them like the honorable criminals. And I think that thing is really smart character design to make Ryan have still kind of this ethic and this moral code with, yeah, these guys are going to get fired regardless of me, you know, like I'm just the messenger. How can I do my job in the best possible way to make them almost like reverse psychology feel like this is an opportunity, even though they're most likely screwed. And so I do think that's a really important choice because yeah, if he was just a total corporate shill with no heart, who doesn't give a second thought to anybody he talks to, then I don't think we would get on board with this movie. Because it's just like, oh, you're just a bad person.
Yeah.
And it's also one of those things where some of his character flaws are hidden in the first act and sort of are being brought out then by, you know, especially Anna Kendrick's character, where it's like he seems like the empathetic one until the woman says, I'm going to jump off a bridge. And she's like, oh my gosh, she's like, do you ever check up on him? And he's like, nah, that there's no good that could come of that. Right. And you're like, oh, okay. So maybe he's not quite, but as you're saying, Alex, the movie kind of has to get us on board with him, even if we just think he's a good guy, quote unquote. But then I love the design of Natalie, because I feel like the easy version of this movie is Clooney gets stuck with his brother-in-law for the movie, right? It's like the Planes, Trains, and Automobiles or something, where it's like, here's the complete opposite of you who has a different set of values, and now they're going to peel it apart. Whereas Natalie and Alex are just sort of clones of this character. They're like, oh, we all have the same philosophy and we all, agree about the way to do things, basically. But they sort of are, you know, the levels are so different, right? Because as we find out with Alex by the end, she is absolutely committed to this way of like compartmentalizing, you know, her lives. Whereas Natalie, you know, she talks big in terms of like, here's the new ideas and here's how we're going to do this. And we don't have to do it in person because we don't care about people. But then, of course, as we start to get to know her, she is very caring and very compassionate and the scene on the dock there where she is just like challenging him about all of his beliefs. So I just think it's like there's like an elegance to the fact that the character, instead of the easy way, which is just have a bunch of characters who are complete opposites of each other, it's have a bunch of characters who are very similar to each other, but the ways in which they're different is so telling. And then it becomes the character web to make the protagonist do what we need the protagonist to do.
Yeah. And it has to do with the tests, right? So as you're pointing out, all the characters are very similar. Natalie espouses the same ideology, but doesn't actually believe in it in her heart, right? And we see that so early on where it's so easy to break her, right? Like the cracks are so obvious, like even in the first, you know, where she's talking to J.K. Simmons. And then we see like, yeah, we know that Vera Farmiga's character, Alex, is like stone cold all the way. So there is this spectrum, but then the situations that the movie puts all of those characters in is those situations are specifically designed to test and test and test, where like the woman who said she's going to jump off a bridge is designed to test Natalie, right? Specifically where it's like, if you say you believe this, do you really, when you're sitting in the room with someone who's dealing with it, right? And then like you have that situation where it's Ryan and it's at the like tech party, which I think is a really fascinating midpoint. Right.
Yeah.
But it's like, do you really love this woman? Like, how do you actually feel? Let's test it in this condition. And then you have, of course, like the wedding and Onward, where it's like testing the Vera Farmiga character, Alex. It's like, are you really going to go to this wedding? Are you really going to show up and be in all of this situation and act like you're a proper girlfriend and everything? And it's interesting because obviously she doesn't go through an arc, right? Like she basically fails that test as like a person. But as a character, right, like succeeds in like living out her entire philosophy. But I just think that the construction of those situations is so perfectly like poking at everybody's philosophies and pushing them to see if they're going to adhere to what they say.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's when the audience knows exactly what those things are, then we're engaged when we're like, oh, they're in a situation that's going to test that thing. Like I'm involved in this movie now. I think it's also really interesting that each of these characters, the age difference, I think plays a really interesting role. And Alex, I think earlier you were saying, you know, you left the theater kind of thinking about your life. And I feel like that the kind of the age differences between those three main characters, and then when you go to the wedding and you see kind of the rest of Ryan's family, like all these people are dealing with relationships and family at different stages. And so it does kind of create this kind of holistic thing. And, you know, there's the hilarious scene where Natalie and Alex and Ryan, when they first meet, and she's like, tell me about like what you wanted when, you know, what you look for in a person, Vera Farmiga. And she lists all those things. And then, the great like one-liner of like, well, that was really depressing, and just like all the perspectives that come with life of like a 20-year-old looking at, you know, someone in their late 30s. And I think all of that just adds like a richness and a texture to all of this that makes each of their perspectives, their differing like takes on that same theme, believable, because they're all in different places in their lives, both time-wise also, which I think helps
a lot.
And once again, the movie, you know, every single character that's brought into the movie does have a kind of a take on the theme. His sisters, you know, one of the sisters is like going through a separation. The other sister is like about to get married, but cold feet. And it's, you know, so there's, you know, we're not in a movie that has like a simplistic moral code where it's like marriage and family equals good and the end. It's like, no, here's examples of people who chose this life to settle down and to varying degrees of success. And maybe this marriage is ending in a lot of unhappiness. So it's not, once again, a cookie cutter movie with like a really black and white theme where it's like, obviously Ryan is wrong and everybody who's married is happy. It's like, no, he has reason to question if that path would work out any better than the path he's chosen. But once again, all those characters are serving that function thematically as well as just their function in the plot. And that's when a movie feels so tight, because it's just like nobody's wasted. They're all supporting that.
And I think that's why I love the story is such a great, you know, the character gets what they need, but not what they want. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So like, it's a story of Ryan learning that, oh, he does maybe want a relationship and a deep connection and a family. Like, he is learning that about himself and opening up and all that stuff, which is great. But in the process, he gets devastated, which was kind of like, you know, I'm sure some of the fear around it in the first place.
Right.
And so I think that is why, as you were talking about earlier, Alex, it leaves you in this kind of weird place where you're like, I'm happy for him that he got to learn this about himself and realize what maybe he really appreciates deep down inside. Maybe it's not 10 million miles. Maybe it's human connection. But man, that sucks that it went that way. And is he going to be okay? And all that stuff. And I like movies where that happens, where the character gets what they need, but not what they want. And it leaves you in that kind of, now I have to figure out how I feel and what do I want? What do I need? Like that kind of thing.
Well, since this is a rom-com sort of dramedy thing in that vein, I do want to spend a minute and talk about the meet cute. Which is the scene where they like encounter each other in the bar. And then they start like immediately start talking about rental cars, right? And like rental car agencies. It's a really clever little piece of dialogue, right? That conversation. Because it gets at all of this, right? Which is like Ryan meets somebody who is so similar to him in a lot of ways. But yeah, is equally matched, has similar interests, like is also clever and on his wavelength where he's like, hey, that new car rental agency, they're not bad. And she's like, is that a joke? Right. He's like, yes, it is.
So
right.
Good.
Where like he like tests her a little bit and she like passes with flying colors. In the script, it's after that moment that they tell each other their names. You know what I'm about to say, Michael? Yeah, there's a parenthetical in the script. So like parentheticals in screenplays are typically for like a delivery that might be unexpected for the line, right? Where you like absolutely need to indicate to the actor, okay, here's what the line says, but the delivery needs to be delivered with this attitude or whatever in order for the line to work at all or make any sense, basically. And you do want to be sparing with them in your script. But in this script, the line is, I'm Ryan, but the parenthetical for the delivery is in italics and it just says, I love you.
So it's like, that's great.
He says, I love, like the line is, I love you, but the line is, I'm Ryan.
Right.
And it just goes such a long way toward the scene when you read it on the page, but then obviously that's like what's imbued. I mean, and Vera Farmiga and George Clooney have amazing chemistry. Mm-hmm. And I was also reading an article about like the editing process on this and going back and forth with like catching the way that they like capturing their chemistry in the way that it's edited, which is really beautiful. But yeah, it's a really great meet cute, and I've talked about it on this podcast 1,000 times, but like if you want us to like a couple, it needs to be based on something. Like they have to have something in common, they have to understand each other in some way, and even those little moments are just like, I love them, be together. Like you guys, there's no one else who would understand the two of you the way that you understand each other. And even the follow-up scene in the in the bedroom, like after
the laptops
they've had sex
at the same time.
Oh, it's so great.
And there's another visual. I love that once they do go to the wedding together, there's like the shot of them and the airport opens with the shot of their suitcases next to each other rolling together. And it's like cute because you know them. It's like, oh, they have their little rolling suitcases together and they're off. And it's another little visual way of showing the relationship.
Yeah, you mentioned the editing, Trisha, and I remember viscerally from the first time I watched the movie, there are looks they give each other when they're getting kind of tipsy at the bar that feel so authentic. Like there's a real twinkle in Clooney's eyes, like looking at her, that you can't fake. And the editing is just so perfect because it just captures these little like super authentic moments of real chemistry. And yeah, like when that's not in a movie where we're supposed to care about the couple, it really can be fatal because we need to have something real pass between these two people to make us like need them to be together. And this movie like strikingly has that in spades in that first peak.
Mm-hmm. And it goes all the way down, right? So thinking about that scene where they're talking Anna Kendrick's character through her breakup, right? Mm-hmm. Where they're all sitting in that lobby bar and right. having a drink or whatever. And he's, you know, Alex is talking about like, here's what I want from a man. And like, here's what I think about things. And George Clooney's character, Ryan, is not saying anything, right? He's just kind of listening to these two women talk about like men and relationships and everything. But the way that the editing is capturing, like there's that two shot of them and he's kind of looking at her a little bit, or like you can see how carefully he's listening to what she's saying. But then you're also like watching Vera Farmiga's performance, and then it cuts back to Anna Kendrick's character and who's like centered in the frame by herself. And then you have like a wide that anyway, it does so much work to keep us in the space with all three of them, because this is character work for all three of them. Mm-hmm. All three of them are expressing things about like what they want and who they are. And that extends to what they want from each other. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, and the shifting dynamics in the scene of like, maybe Ryan is the one, like maybe it is the thing, Alex, like listen to what you're saying, like you can see him wondering too, and the editing like makes sure to get that in the two shot or like even in the close-up of him, of like him listening and being like maybe, and you see the wheels turning. Beautiful. It's masterful.
Yeah, the other thing I want to say about the filmmaking is that I really like that there's a there's no unnecessary music score. Like there's a yeah. lot of moments where they're like, no score. We're just going to have the dialogue, the scene play. And there is score and it's great. And it comes in when it needs to. But I like that it doesn't over rely on the score to tell us how we're supposed to feel about what's happening in any given moment. And I think that's, you know, you can do that when, as we're saying, you have these great performances, great characters that are great on the page, but also these performances where there is real chemistry and you can see the wheels turning and you understand the subtext. You don't need to like put in a little, you know, I don't know, like a harp going by being like, look, they're in love, audience. Like we feel it just from watching them and sitting with them in those moments.
I also feel like Clooney, for, you know, as many movies as he's been in, he tends to play the character who is sort of unbreakable, you know, like Danny Ocean or something, right? Or he's playing the idiot in like the Coen Brothers movies, you know, that kind of thing. And I think it's refreshing. There's like a little run in the aughts with this and Syriana and Michael Clayton and The American, I think, where he played people who just felt sort of broken and off and that kind of thing. And it's like for somebody, you know, who is that like that perfect, beautiful, like statue of an actor, you know, it's like there's something very compelling when you see them play a character who has, like as you were saying, Alex, just those little looks and those little moments, those little vulnerabilities that make them feel like a human being.
Yeah, he really, including this movie, feels maybe as vulnerable as I've ever seen him, you know. Mm-hmm. he has like this, he has that cool facade and his kind of corporate, you know, efficiency. But right below that, there's a lot of kind of sadness and like an easily hurt little boy is like right there, and you can really feel it. And there's so many scenes where it's, you can feel that facade is almost just barely holding together. When, you know, when he asks his sister, like, do you have somebody to walk you down the aisle? And, yeah. you know, playing off like, oh, cool, just making sure, just, you know, just making sure that you're covered. Even early on in the movie, when his neighbor comes in,
yep.
and we have this whole hint at like this kind of ongoing relationship. And, you know, he's playing it off as, oh, cool, great, you're seeing somebody. But yeah, from the beginning, Clooney plays it where like this guy does not have much standing between this cool facade and a lot of kind of pain and insecurity and hurt. And I think that is what makes the movie so compelling for me, is watching a character who is like really just riding that boundary the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. And that it's, you know, each of those moments are these, like you're saying, these little moments of vulnerability. And I love that they're just kind of sprinkled throughout and kind of serve as the big turning points in the movie. Also, like, Like the, you know, the midpoint scene where Anna Kendrick is pretending she can't sing, and they're sitting on the boat.
I thought about that. Yeah. I was like, yeah. Girl, carry a tune. We all know.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a Clooney and Vera Farmiga sitting on the back of the boat. And there's that moment where he's like, you know, she brings up the backpack and he just says, recently I've been thinking I needed to empty the backpack to know what to put back in. And like just that one line, and that's kind of the only thing he says like in dialogue about where he's at, but that tells us so much because we know all the stuff about him and that his philosophy is, it's the midpoint thing. He's kind of getting it, but he's not ready to fully commit to all of that stuff. And then yeah, when at the airport, when after the wedding, when Vera Farmiga's leaving and she says, you know, call me when you get lonely. He says, I'm lonely, which is something he never would have said in the beginning of the movie. And it's just those two words. But and you like, you get it and you understand how vulnerable he's making himself in those moments.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those amazing, just perfect, you know, directing, writing performances where, you know, she's almost saving him by playing like a joke. Like she laughs like, haha, yeah, like you're lonely already. But like the way he says it is so vulnerable and like he's not even able to pretend anymore. Like when he says, I'm lonely, he says it with a, like a little bit of a smile so that like the joke interpretation is available, but it's so not a joke.
Right. It's him saying like, I love you, come back.
Right. Like, please don't leave.
Yeah. I think one of the critical things that the movie does is sell us on their relationship in a thousand subtle ways. Like there are some big ways that it sells us on their relationship where we, like we talked about, like the first time they have sex, they're like perfectly in sync and like they, you know, like are like, okay, well, let's meet up and do this again. This was all really great. And the meet cute's really great. And like that first romantic encounter, we like buy it. We'd like them together. And then that, they have that phone call, right, where she's like, why didn't you call me? And he's like, well, I didn't really know what I was supposed to do. And she's like, you don't need to worry about it. But, like, clearly she likes him, right? That's, like, the very act of, like, her calling him, even though she's, like, passing it off as being, like, really breezy and, like, it's fine. But she called him in the first place to, like, say that. Again, we're like, we like this. But the work of the wedding sequence where she like agrees to go to the wedding, they like break into his high school, right? But then there's this, and that's all like cute. And it's just sort of like standard sort of rom-com-y, like, how can we put these two characters in a quirky, cute, kind of weird situation?
I love when she's is that all you got? And she does her little like look.
Yeah. No, it's really great. It's a really good example of that kind of sequence. But the sequence itself is not that unusual in a rom-com. What is unusual, though, is that when all of these situations arise with his family, where like his brother-in-law's Danny McBride gets cold feet and he has to go talk to him, she like takes him to drop him off and is like, I'll pick up your suit. And she just like, that's all she says. Not like, you got it. You're going to be great. You're whatever. She doesn't lay it on too thick. It's true to the character, but it's a supportive note that like, again, these are the subtle ways that make the relationship feel more like real and special. And two, like when he's talking to his sisters after the reception and she's like, I'm going to go take care of these flowers for you or whatever it is. She's like, I'll take care of this box. I'll just go put it away. Where she's helping out and seems aware of the needs of all the people in the room. Right. And there's so much about how she's great throughout that entire wedding sequence in very sort of small and subtle ways, in addition to the big ways that make that relationship feel like extra special, like we really, really want it to work out.
Yeah. I think in the director's commentary for this movie, if that exists somewhere, I remember, Jason Reitman talking about that moment that you pointed out of the like, I'll go grab your suit, where he's saying exactly what you said of like, it's a small moment, but we're getting to see them work together as a team, and like that's so much fun to see them coming together and really be a couple in that way. So there are so many amazing things to talk about with Up in the Air. Why don't we move to lessons and look at it through that lens? Alex, do you want to start? What's your lesson for Up in the Air?
Sure. I mean, So I always think, I mean, the image from this movie that always sticks in my head is the twist moment. And mm-hmm. I think that moment is worth studying, is just to see an example of really efficient, powerful filmmaking where, you know, there's many different versions of that scene you could think of. I mean, maybe she comes outside and they have a conversation right then and there where she, everything's explained, or, you know, he encounters her husband. There's a lot of different ways that can go down, but the way the scene is shot where she opens the door, we just get pieces of visual and like audio information, the bare minimum information we need at the right moments to create this like perfect little arc of heartbreak.
Yeah.
But it doesn't overstay its welcome. Nothing is said. It's just a look between them.
Well, he says I was in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then she says to her husband, oh, no, just wrong door or something.
Someone who's lost.
That's right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Perfect. Anyway, yeah, I just think that moment is worth studying because I think that reveal could have been a lot less powerful and maybe less unsettling if it was done in a less masterful way. Mm. But I think just the exact length of the moment, that like silent, horrible moment, the exact information that is revealed at the time it is revealed just adds up to this just perfect, perfect scene that sticks with you afterwards because of how well it's constructed.
Yeah.
Just wanted to shout out the twist moment because it's so good.
Ooh.
And again, that's another great moment without score, that doesn't lean on score. Like, yeah, could have been a violin as he's racing to her house, and then there's a million bad ways to do that with the music, but it lets it be quiet so we can hear the things like you're saying. And then, yeah, that smash cut to like the wide where we're looking at him through the window of the hotel, and it's just like snow and wind.
Right. Yeah.
Like, yeah, I feel like all of that together just makes you have to sit with it. And the agony of it, and it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'll jump in next because my lesson is also about that moment, not about the way that it's done, as Alex was talking about, but more about the inclusion of it at all. I've talked a couple times on the podcast, I think in Q&As, about Q's and A. Q's and A's, they're both. about these movies where I call it the protagonist learns their lesson, but it's too late. As opposed to the movies where the protagonist learns their lesson and they're victorious at the end, you know. And the problem is I don't like to name movies when I talk about this. And I always want to talk about Up in the Air, but I'm like, I don't know who has seen that, right? So like the safer movies I mentioned are American Beauty. I would say American History X is kind of safe, where it's like you kind of get the ooh, you learned and it's okay now, but no, sorry, it took too long for you to learn your lesson. Therefore, you actually are being punished, you know? And what I like about that is I like the urgency it gives to the theme, like to you as the audience member watching this movie. It's like the meta message is saying, it's not just saying you can clean up your act whenever and you'll be fine. It's saying like, if you wait too long, there could be consequences, you know? And this movie, it's not like she got married, you know, a week ago or something like that. Like she's always been the entire time, but I think it does still sort of do that same work of saying like, yeah, you waited until now when you're, you know, however old you are to learn this lesson. Guess what? The first person who comes along isn't going to be the person. So you're going to have to do some work now, you know, and that's why I love the movie opens on that open-ended, just, welp, here we go, but he is ready, which is also nice because the movie gets to kind of do both. It's like he loses the immediate battle. He loses the, you know, as you were saying, Michael, I thought about you watching this time, getting what you need, but not what you want, basically, which is, you know, a common thing. So it's like he loses that immediate thing that he wants. And that is the thing that we as the audience want for him. But then of course, in the last 10 minutes of the movie, we're like, well, no, I guess what we really want is for you to go through this kind of, you know, philosophical change, you know, ideological change, I should say. So it's unfortunate that you don't get the thing that you want, that we want for you too. But the important thing is that when you are looking at the list of flights and wondering where to go, we know what that means, right? We know mm-hmm. that means you are in a good place now. So I like that this movie kind of gets away with both. But the one thing I really wanted to talk about was the sort of the gut punch you can give your audience by having a character who you think who did learn their lesson and you think is going to go and you know, run and get the, you know, get their partner and whatever. And nope, sorry, because they spent too long with that simple ideology that they had that there's consequences. It's not that easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. Trisha.
Yeah. I actually sort of have, I guess what seems like sort of a simple screenwriting lesson, but it has to do with trajectory and like where your movie is going and just telling your audience it. Or I guess like another simple way to put this is like ticking clocks. This movie has three ticking clocks. It starts off by telling us there's a wedding. So we know the wedding is coming. We know Ryan is going to the wedding. There's no way for him to get out of it in as much as he would like to. So the wedding is ticking clock number one. Ticking clock number two is his job is coming to an end, mm-hmm. right? Mm. He gets to go out on this last like roadshow tour to show Anna Kendrick how it's done, but it's going to be over, right? Like probably this is just, he's going to be called back in. His entire way of life is sort of coming to an end. And so this is kind of like the last hurrah on the road. And a lot depends on how they do in this like last tour of sort of firing people. And then the third one is this number he has in mind that he hasn't hit yet. And so the movie has these like deadlines for the character. And it's like, by this time, something will need to change, probably. By this time, something will need to change. By this time, something will need to change. And it also creates the story threads of the entire thing, right? Like, he doesn't have a date to the wedding. He has to go. He has to take pictures of this, like, these silly, like, cardboard cutouts. It gives him and Anna Kendrick something to do while they talk about their philosophies, while they, like, yeah, argue about life and whatever. Meanwhile, there are stakes to all of it because, you know, the job is coming to an end and the job is his entire way of life. Like, I think in the script after Anna Kendrick's presentation, her name's Natalie, sorry. After Natalie's presentation, the script action line says Ryan is having a panic attack, right? And then it cuts to him in the room with like Jason Bateman's character. And he's like, you can't be serious. This is crazy. This will never work. Like, and you know that he's not really arguing because he cares about like the people he's firing, but it's obviously selfishly driven. So we know that there's this desperation on his part to hang on to like his job that enables his way of life, right? So that's like the second layer. And then this third layer is at some point you're going to hit your miles. And then what are you going to do now, right? Everything you're doing is in service of getting these miles, is in service of like this manifestation, this literalization of your life philosophy of like, you do everything that you do for like this quote unquote loyalty and these quote unquote points and the status that you think you can earn. But what are you going to do when you earn it? And so in the movie, like in the last act, right at the end of the second act, and then at the climax of the third act, and then the very close, it hits all three of those milestones of that trajectory that the ticking clocks that they promised us they would hit. And each one is satisfying because of the journey on the way to get there. And I feel like with dramedies, you know, these things are like, I guess, technically subplots, but they're also interwoven and they do create the spine of the plot and the spine of the character arc in a really clever way. I think it's just really worth studying that it's like, you think one ticking clock for the big game or for the like save the rec center like thing is enough. It's not. Build more into it. Yes. Like have more pressure on your characters, and deadlines put pressure on characters, and it's okay to have more than one. It's okay to have three.
Yeah. Well, and I love that because, as you mentioned, they're all introduced very early. They're introduced when Ryan is still very much stuck in his old self. So we know how early Ryan feels about all those things of like, I don't want to go to a wedding and I really want my job more than anything. And I can't wait to hit 10 million miles. And then by the end, all three of those things.
There's four ticking clocks because there's that speaking engagement in Vegas that he rushes out on to go get Alex.
Right.
Yeah.
There's four ticking clocks.
Four. And that one counts too, where like all of those things, how he felt in the beginning, he feels exactly the opposite about them by the end.
Right.
And that's, we feel that because there is character change being demonstrated in front of us.
Yes.
Yeah. And also the ticking clock, you know, usually the term ticking clock, I think there's like an anxiety attached to it, you know, like Taken or something, right? Where it's just oh my God, we have to get to the place by the time. But yeah, it's not ticking clock in the way of like a thing has to happen by a certain time. So you don't like, this movie is very comfortable to watch. It doesn't feel, you know, anxiety inducing. So it's more that like there are these like, I don't know what the right word is, ticking clock or like loose thread or whatever it is, but there's something that like there's like a promise.
In some ways.
Say it again.
Milestones,
right. Or like a promise. There's something that's going to happen, you know? Yeah. So we know that there's something like an unanswered question that we are waiting for, but also it's not just this anxiety inducing thing where every scene we're going, oh my, he has to get to the place because otherwise he's not going to get to Vegas.
Exactly.
It's not that kind of movie, obviously.
Right. They don't need to be cheap, right? I think that's thing is that ticking clocks are associated with like cheapness of like, here's a countdown and it's a literal bomb that's going to count down. It's going to stop on the two. Like, it doesn't need to be that way. They can just be important events for the character by which time they will be tested or at which they will be tested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 So I think I have kind of like two mini lessons. And the first one kind of came to me when I was listening to you, Brian, talk about Ryan's arc and, you know, again, that he gets what he needs, but not what he wants. It's also impressive that I didn't really appreciate until thinking about it just now that Natalie also has an arc. And it's kind of the opposite in some ways where like, you know, if Ryan's thing is like, I don't want to settle and I don't need to be, you know, I don't need to care about relationships or I don't know. Basically, Natalie learns like to not settle either, to like not just go, like to not treat, you know, to be like more precious with love. I don't know. I'm trying to figure out like how to say it, but like don't settle with the guy that you thought would be fine and move to Omaha with him. Like go pursue your dreams. Like you're still young and like look for the thing that really means something. And so I also just appreciate that this movie has room in its theme for like two manifestations of the final form of that.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I was thinking about when watching it this time is that all the different acts, you know, 1, 2A, 2B, climax, all have different like settings, and that really helps us like move through the movie and the phases and the seasons of time as he's changing. You know, we see him in his early stage, but he gets called back home. And so it's work stuff. And then he's on the road with Natalie. And we're flying here. And we're flying like kind of 2A is America is where it's set as they're flying around firing people. And then it's the wedding. So yeah, I just think that it's just good. I think it helps you, it kind of ties into what you were saying, Trish, of giving the audience like trajectory and sort of setting expectations of like, we're at the wedding now. Like this is the part of the movie where we're going to be at the wedding and we're in this phase of things. So I appreciated that about the movie a lot also.
Yeah.
So many lessons.
Good.
It's a pretty good movie.
Yeah. Want to watch it again?
Yeah. Well, since we can't do that, what have we been watching recently? Kind of segue worked. Alex, what have you been watching recently?
Why can't we watch Up in the Air?
Because we're talking about it, right? Yeah, it doesn't make sense. Alex, what have you been watching recently?
So I watched 15 Minutes of Shame, which is a documentary on HBO Max, produced by our friend Kristen Weiland. And it is a really interesting documentary that I highly recommend. It was also produced by Monica Lewinsky. And it's basically studying the phenomenon of social shaming and how that has, you know, manifested in the internet era. And the kind of the premise for the doc is that Monica Lewinsky was like patient zero of the internet age of like social shaming. Like that was early internet kind of like the whole Monica Lewinsky phenomenon was like the first time the internet was around for like a public shaming event. And the documentary goes into like personal stories, but also kind of the sociology of public shaming and why humans like are so like almost like human society has always had some form of public shaming. And now we have these tools and social media and the internet that has just like amplified it and like virused it in this like really strange way that is just like not good. and it gets into all different kinds of public shaming. There's the kind of there's stories where it's like somebody did do like a bad thing that they like regret doing, but they're like a whole person and their lives are over. Or there's people who are, it's like they're African-American and one like college president and then like couldn't leave their house forever because a right-wing group decided to target them. Mm-hmm. And so it's like it goes into the fact that like this isn't a left or right issue. This is just they're human beings, and we currently live in a world in which like a human being's life can be destroyed for basically nothing because of this like insane amplification and like anonymousness of public shaming we live in right now. So yeah, very pertinent and interesting and complex movie that isn't like, we talk about like cancel culture or these things, you think it's like a left or right kind of political issue, but this gets at the more sociology of it and the psychology of it and the really like the human cost for individuals of the phenomenon. So highly recommended, 15 Minutes of Shame on HBO Max.
Nice.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Trisha, what have you been watching?
Yeah. So I, a couple of weeks ago, got to virtually attend Sundance this year, and it was amazing. Tremendous lineup of movies, and I will be talking to you about them as they come out. One of the ones that is coming out very soon and is out in certain parts of the world is probably my favorite movie that I saw. But was not a Sundance exclusive, which was The Worst Person in the World.
Yeah.
And yeah, you saw it, Bri. Mm-hmm. God, it's so good. Like, yep. It's so good. It's a dramedy, I guess. It's nominated, actually, you know, the Oscar nominations just came out. And it's nominated for foreign language film, but it's directed by Joachim Trier, I want to say his name is. And it was, it stars, I'm going to mess up her name, I apologize in advance, it's Renate Reinsev. It's so beautiful. It's just this really fantastic portrait of like a young woman in like the most confused stage of her life, basically. And it just captures so much of like relationships and life and, this sort of like sense of indecisiveness and unsettledness. And it's so funny and it's so sad. And it's just a really wonderful little movie. So, if you have the chance to see The Worst Person in the World, I had heard like so many people hyping it up and I thought no chance, it's as good as people say. But it's really wonderful to watch. It's one of these movies that's divided into chapters.
Oh, yeah.
And like, it's like divided into 13 chapters and like it has like a prologue and an epilogue. And it just tells you this story about this person and all the people sort of in her orbit and how they all sort of like, how she sort of thinks of them all and relates to them all. But it's just so beautifully shot and the central character is so magnetic. It's wonderful.
Yeah, what like maybe my favorite performance of the year.
Yeah. I mean, yes. It's strong recommend.
Keep hearing good things, and I keep hearing good things. So I guess I'm gonna have to go watch it. That sounds great. Awesome. Brian, what have you been watching?
Well, speaking of Oscar nominated foreign films, since the nominations just came out, I figured it'd be a good time to talk about Drive My Car.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Which is a Japanese film based on a short story by Haruki Murakami, who I haven't read that short story, but I've read a couple of his books and a couple of his short stories. And he's named multiple after Beatles songs like this one. But I always like him as a writer. He didn't write this movie, but like he just has a good balance of kind of like up in the air where it's like there's like a lightness to it and a funness to it. But at the same time, you're very clearly being told about a theme and they're very clearly discussing something. So the main character of Drive My Car is an actor and a director, and his wife is a screenwriter. And she reads the scripts that he is working on, that the plays that he's in, she reads the other characters' parts, and then he listens to that on a tape as he either drives or is driven to rehearsal. So he, like, part of his routine is he's an hour away from where he is going so that he can listen to that tape on the way. And I don't want to talk too much about the plot because it's a 3-hour movie. So, like, be prepared for that. But, like, what I would call early plot stuff is like 30 minutes into the movie. So it's like, I don't even want to mention what that is. But the movie very, very clearly and very sort of playfully, the things that she is reading as he is driving from, you know, Uncle Vanya or King Lear or whatever it is, are very clearly speaking about what the character is going through and what the plot is dealing with. And there are times where she is telling him about a story that she's writing, and that clearly is talking about sort of where their relationship is or was or whatever. And then the young woman who is driving him is also, she becomes an important character as the story goes on. And then again, it's sort of a character thing. It's doing all these really interesting things. It is, again, a 3-hour movie. So by the time, like, watch it in one sitting if you can. I watched it in parts, and I felt like by the time I got to the end, like, maybe the magic had worn off or something. I still think it's a beautiful movie and I really liked it, but I would say it's one of those movies like Roma where it's just like, just don't let yourself kind of leave the space of the movie when you watch it. And yeah, I'm just really happy to see it get so many recommendations or accolades,
nominations
and everything. Yeah, because I think that it I just think it was really compelling, and it doesn't feel 3 hours long. Like, it doesn't feel slow, even though it's just kind of a drama of people talking. It feels compelling, and it feels like I enjoyed every second of watching it.
Nice. Very cool.
Michael?
So I watched Nightmare Alley, the new Guillermo del Toro movie.
I almost talked about that. I'm so curious to hear your thoughts.
You watched it? Because I was going to say, I don't know that you should watch it and or skip certain parts, because there are certainly some parts.
There's hot fuzziness towards the end.
No, it's okay. I just covered my eyes.
Great.
I like stood next to my TV for a minute. But what I was going to say is that I saw the original, so also I knew what was going to happen.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
That would be a fun conversation.
Yeah, I don't think you should, actually. If you're interested in the new one, don't watch the original.
Okay.
Because it does kind of spoil, like, I think the suspense is a big part of the experience of the new one.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was going to say, I mean, so it's for people that don't know, how do you summarize this? It's like,
it's a carnival crime noir.
Right. Yeah. Right. Carney at the protagonist, the center. And it's, Carney crime noir. It's really interesting. It was a movie that I was on the side of the whole time, and, like, overall I was, like, entertained by and, like, kept rooting for it, but also kept bumping up against some weird decisions in the execution and the pacing, where, like, the first act feels like it's almost an hour long and the whole movie is only, like, 2.5 hours. So weird pacing things, but it's like, it's kind of held together with, as you were alluding to, Trisha, this, like, tension and, like, mystery of, like, kind of wanting to understand what's going on. And then the performances, you know, Bradley Cooper, Kate Blanchett, Toni Collette, Willem Dafoe, Richard Jenkins, Rooney Mara, David Strathairn, Ron Perlman, Mary Steenburgen,
Hope McCallum.
Yeah.
It's so a Carol, like, reunion in a weird way, because they're even dressed like
that. Right. So it was a really fascinating watch and thinking about, because I just watched Up in the Air and this idea of, like, 90s movies that we don't make anymore. It felt like it was maybe trying to capture some of that of, like, oh, this is a drama and it's just about these characters and all the stuff. But it was also just really disturbing in ways that felt tonally beyond the spectrum of what needed to be there for the movie. Like, it didn't need to be that gory Guillermo, like, that didn't add anything to it was a bumpy experience, but it was interesting, and I feel like I learned a lot and had a lot of thoughts about writing and filmmaking the whole time, whether or not it was do this or don't do this. It was a learning experience.
To be clear, the original is excellent. Like,
interesting.
I loved the original. I saw it a couple of years ago, and before I knew they were going to remake it. And it is excellent. And so I was like, we're remaking this? Interesting. And it's, the remake is very similar in a lot of ways. The plot is exactly the same.
Interesting.
And so, yeah, if you want to be surprised by the plot of this new one, don't watch the original. But then I would recommend going back to watch the original if you are interested in it, because it is a really, really good movie in its own right.
I'm curious, is 1947, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. And all of this based on a book that came out in 1946. Yeah, so definitely made me interested in where all this came from. Never going to hear the word geek the same way ever again.
Nope, it's all over now.
Unfortunately. So
you clearly never read Geek Love by, was it Catherine Dunn in the 90s? It's a whole situation.
If you want to know a lot more about the origin of the word geeks, Nightmare Alley is available now.
Also stunning production design. Yes, absolutely stunning. Like, my jaw was on the floor.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay. Well, this has been our conversation about Up in the Air. We want to say thank you, as always, to our producer, Vince Major, and our editor, Eric Schneider. I'm Michael Tucker, and I've been joined today by Trisha Rand, Brian Bittner, and Alex Kayotos. As always, our Twitter handles are in the show notes. Send us a tweet and say hi, and we will see you in the next episode.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.